Thank you, Bill. Thank you all for being here. I know you all have a day job, and taking a day off to be with us here is a testimony of your commitment to energy security. Tonight, after this event wraps up, we have a State of the Union address, and President Obama will report before Congress where things stand. And I've been referring to previous State of Union addresses of the past 25 years, and 24 of them really dedicate more than a paragraph to the issue of our dependence on oil. So clearly we've had every president since General Eisenhower talking about the dependence on oil. And, you know, President Eisenhower said that once this country is 20% dependent on oil, we'll find ourselves in trouble. That was in the 1950s, and then all the way up to today, we're still talking about it, and things don't seem to be improving. On the contrary, things seem to be getting worse. In fact, last year we paid, as a nation, more for gasoline than in any other year in history. So you want to ask yourself is, you know, if 10 presidents are talking about a problem and are not able to solve the problem, maybe it's a good idea to go back to the basics and ask ourselves, maybe we're not clearly understand what the problem is. You know, if you go to the doctor and for many, many years, the doctor writes a prescription and you take the medication and nothing ever happens, maybe the doctor misdiagnosed the problem. And my main thesis is that the reason we don't get much progress on this issue is because we have not diagnosed the problem correctly. The problem is not our dependence on foreign oil. Think about it. We're talking today, a few months ago, there was a trouble in Libya. We barely import oil from Libya, but when the riots began in Libya, oil prices went up $25 a barrel. We paid, even though we don't import oil from Libya. We don't import a drop of oil from Iran. Do you think that if there's trouble in the Middle East and the Strait of Hormuz, it will not affect us? It has nothing to do with how much oil we import or not import. In fact, our dependence on foreign oil has been going down quite drastically over the past 7 years. In 2005, we imported 60% of our oil. Last year, 2011, we imported only 45% of our oil, according to the Department of Energy. So, you know, we went from 60 to 45. But at the same time that we reduced our dependence on oil, on foreign oil, that is, by a number of barrels is equivalent to three times what we import from Saudi Arabia, let's look what happened to our economy over the same period of time. Well, our national oil bill went up from about 250 million barrels of $250 billion to $375 billion. In other words, it went up by 50%. That's the amount of money that we pay as a nation to import our oil. The share of oil in our trade deficit went up from 33% to 52%, and what we pay at the gas station went up by 65%. So something is clearly wrong with this picture. You know, we are less dependent on foreign oil, but we become poorer. So clearly something is wrong with our method. We need to understand what is the problem. The problem is not how much we import. Even if we had a president that was the driller-in-chief, and he said, drill everywhere, and we become 100% self-sufficient in oil. We don't even import oil from Canada, okay? Let's imagine what happened. Would that insulate us from troubles in the Middle East? Would that reduce the amount of money that the Saudis and the Iranians and the Venezuelans make per barrel? Would OPEC be less influential in the world sphere? Absolutely not. Because, and it was mentioned before, The problem is that we do not have control over the price of oil. The real problem is not how much we import. It is not how much we consume even. We don't care how many bananas we import. We import 100% of our coffee that we drink every morning. But we don't care about where the coffee is coming from, what's the price, you know, because we have competition. If something is wrong with the supply of coffee, we can drink tea, we can drink hot chocolate, whatever you want. The problem is the monopoly of oil over the transportation sector. And that means monopoly not only in cars and trucks, it's in ships, it's in planes. The transportation sector underlies world commerce. And world commerce underlies the global economy. And oil has a virtual monopoly over the transportation sector by virtue of the fact that every car, truck, ship, and plane that is deployed anywhere around the world is warranted and is made to run on oil and oil alone, with the exception of some of the cars that you have here, but the flex fuel vehicles. But let's look at the big numbers. We put on the road last year 13 million cars in America. Most of them, if you open the manual, you read the manual, it says you can only use gasoline. Okay? So that is the problem. And when we looked at this challenge of this monopoly, we realized that we've been there before as humanity. We had a similar situation in history, not that distant history, when the world was dependent on a very different commodity, and we wanted to see how the world dealt with this dependency. In this book, Turning Oil into Salt, that I'd be happy to sign later at booth number 40, we describe basically the same pathology. For the entire human history, salt had a monopoly over food preservation. Salt, because of this monopoly, underlied world affairs. Countries used to go to war over salt. Colonies were built around who has salt. There was a whole subtext to foreign relations that had to do with the politics of salt. Salt had the same power that oil has today. Just like salt used to dominate food preservation, oil today dominates transportation. So we have a very similar situation here. And if you remember, even the word salary comes from the word salt, because Roman soldiers used to get their salary in salt. That's how they were paid. Now, 200 years ago, in fact, this month, 200 years ago, Napoleon was considering his march into Russia. He started building up the Grand Armée, 450,000 soldiers that marched into Russia, and only 25,000 came back. It's one of the worst military disasters in history. Napoleon was very concerned about his salt dependency. He realized that when armies march on their stomachs, and if you want to supply your army with food, you need a lot of salt. So he was always very preoccupied, just like today we are very preoccupied with our oil dependency. At that time, the leaders of that time were very preoccupied with their salt dependency. And he introduced a prize to the person that could find a solution to France's salt dependency. And long and behold, came a French chef by the name of Nicolas Appert, and he came up with the first form of canning. He found a way to preserve food in cans so that we don't need to cure it with salt. And at the very same time that canning was developed in Europe, refrigeration was developed in Philadelphia, in this side of the Atlantic, by an American inventor. And those two technologies, canning and refrigeration, essentially ended the monopoly of salt over food preservation. From that moment onward, salt lost its strategic status and became just another commodity. I don't know how many people in this room know whether we are dependent on salt or we're not dependent on salt, or who are the biggest holders of salt in the world. Anybody knows? Do you care? Well, you don't care because salt is just another commodity. It's not that important. We aren't going to send the 82nd Division to take over some salt deposit somewhere, right? And I think that really brings to bear what is the problem that we are facing here. The problem we're facing with regards to oil is oil's monopoly over transportation. And by extension, those countries that enable the monopoly are the countries that control the world economy. And those are the countries of OPEC. Okay, and let me explain that we have a monopoly on the one hand, over a virtual monopoly, and somebody called it before the federal gasoline mandate. I agree with this characterization, and that's exactly what we have today. But it's much worse than that. Because on the one hand, we have a monopoly, but on the other hand, we have a cartel. And I want to tell you a little bit about what this cartel has been doing, because in this book, Turning Oil into Salt, we looked at the history of the activities of this cartel and how for decades they have been manipulating oil prices and by restricting the amount of oil that they pour into the market. OPEC controls today 80% of the world's known conventional crude reserves. 80%, 80. But they only produce about one-third of the world's world production. So the folks that have 80% of the stuff only produce a third. And the folks that have 20% of the stuff produce the remaining two-thirds. So clearly there's something wrong with the balance here. The other thing that is happening is we notice that OPEC always responds to what we do with regards to our energy policy. They adjust their production accordingly. So every time we have a president that says, drill, baby, drill, and we become a nation, we begin to drill and increase our production, OPEC decreases its production by the exact same level to keep the same amount of oil in the market. And as you know, oil is a fungible commodity. The price of oil is equal to anybody around the world. Doesn't matter if you are in China or India or US, you pay $100. You don't get a discount for sitting on a pool of oil, okay? So oil, I have to remember it, it's a fungible commodity. Now, as I said, we drill more, they drill less. The same thing, by the way, happens when we use less, when we go on a diet, and we, for whatever reason, whether because of a recession or because we improve our fuel efficiency standard, because whether we impose gasoline tax, no matter, choose whatever policy that will drive demand less, we drill less, OPEC responds with production cuts. Okay, so the formula to remember here, when we drill more, they drill less. When we use less, they drill less. And that's all you need to understand about the world global market, the world market. That's what you need to understand. It is irrelevant what we do here if we continue the monopoly. If the petroleum standard, if oil remains the only game in town, then every time we respond with static changes, with static responses, OPEC can respond with dynamic responses. And they're always going to have the upper hand, because they see it on the reserves. Now, even more interestingly, if you look at the number of barrels that OPEC produces today, it is almost identical to the number of barrels that they produced 30 or 40 years ago. Just before the oil embargo of 1973, they produced 30 million barrels of oil. Today, they produce 30 million barrels of oil. The world economy doubled. We have China, we have India, we have all of those major drivers in demand. They produce today the exact same number of barrels that they produced almost 40 years ago. It's unbelievable, but at the same time, very understandable. Well, and I understand where they're coming from. Well, when you have a group of countries that do not know how to produce anything other than terrorism and oil and a little bit of gas, then, and they have a fast-growing population that is very young and doesn't pay taxes. You know, a few weeks ago there was a piece in 60 Minutes about Qatar, and they presented Qatar as one this paradise on earth, and people don't pay taxes and they get all the goodies. Well, Yeah, you don't pay taxes, and you expect to get all the goodies, cradle to grave. Salaries, jobs, housing, subsidies, food, everything. Interestingly, when the Arab Spring started last year, look what happened to the countries that had oil and those countries that don't have oil. Look at Egypt and look at Saudi Arabia. How come the revolution succeeded in Egypt but failed in Saudi Arabia? Well, because the Saudis had the ability to double their budget overnight, which is exactly what happened. The Saudi king was recovering from a surgery here in the United States. Riot started. He went back to his country. And the first thing he did, he doubled the Saudi budget. And now people are getting 50% salary increases across the board, all government employees, free rent, food subsidies, all kind of goodies. And now they're happy. They don't have a reason to go out to the streets and riots. But then the question is, who's paying for it? We are paying for it. And I find it to be amazing that we have this national discussion here in this country about entitlements and social spending and all kind of government programs that we need to cut. And at the same time, our money is funding entitlement programs in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Qatar and the United Arab Emirates. That's exactly what happens. We are sending our money, more and more of our money, so that they can retire earlier, so they can get higher salaries and free housing. How smart that is. And that will continue to be the case because Saudi Arabia and all of those countries don't have any other way to generate revenue. And a lot of people ask me, what do you think is going to be the price of oil, I don't know, 5 years from now, 10 years from now? And I always say, look, I don't know, but let me look at the Saudi budget. Because all I have to do is figure out what should be the break-even point for the price of barrel for them to stay afloat economically. And that's how you know what will be the price of a barrel. We have a welfare system, an international welfare system, in which we keep in power through our gasoline purchases a group of corrupt, dictatorial, and in some cases primitive dictatorships. And I don't know at what point we're going to wake up and realize that this is one of the biggest follies in history. And by the way, they happen to hate us. I mean, the Iranians and the Saudis hate each other. The Sunnis and the Shiites hate. But you can take it to the bank that they hate us more than they hate each other. It's sort of like they hate each other like, Coke and Pepsi, okay? They compete over who has a more radical ideology and who could destroy Israel faster, things like this. But really, there's not a lot of a difference there. And they certainly don't like us. So, all I'm saying is, let's stop for a minute, realize what is the problem, realize that everything we've done since the Eisenhower days have not been very effective, and we've got to go into a whole different mindset and develop a whole new strategy. And the strategy starts with a very simple word that was raised here before several times, and that is choice, fuel choice. Okay, why do we need fuel choice? Because, again, if we have cars that do not enable us to use anything other than petroleum, then we are forever going to be beholden to petroleum, and we keep on putting on the road every year 10, 15 million cars that are petroleum only. And by the way, those cars are going to be on the road for 15 years. That's the average life cycle of an American car, okay? So every time you put a new car that can run only on petroleum, it's as if you extended your lease on petroleum dependency for another 15 years. And when you talk to petroleum experts and you ask them, what's going to happen in the petroleum world in 15 years from now? They say, oh, it doesn't look too good. You know, we have China, we have India, we have all these. It doesn't look too good. So why we keep on digging? You know, the first thing you do when you're in a hole, you stop digging. Well, we are digging faster than ever. And so are other countries, by the way. So how do we turn oil into salt? Well, the most important thing we need to do, and it can be done by Congress today with a stroke of a pen, and that is to pass a bill that says that you cannot And I repeat, you cannot sell a car in the United States unless it offers you some subset of fuel choice. And you know what? I'm not going to tell them which technology, which fuel. In some parts of the country, it may be ethanol. In some parts of the country, it may be methanol. In some parts of the country, it could be natural gas, electricity. You decide as a consumer. It's sort of like in my family, you know. I like to drink my coffee black, okay? You saw last night, right? My wife likes a lot of milk in her coffee. My daughter is allergic to milk, so she can have milk, but only soy milk or rice milk, okay? We have choice. I don't want the government to tell me how much milk I need to put in my coffee, and I don't want the government to tell me how much of this and that I need to put in my tank. Let me decide, based on my economic conditions, based on my political proclivities, based on my environmental preferences, let me decide. But give me the platform that enables me to make those choices. So the bill that needs to come out of Congress needs to say this. You cannot sell a car in the United States unless it offers some sort of fuel choice. It can run on gasoline, but also something else. And there is a bill like this, happens to be today pending before Congress. It's called the Open Fuel Standard Act. It was presented before the Senate. It was presented before the House. Now, in the House, we have some members of the Iowa delegation that are on board. Not all of them are on board. At least two that come to mind that are not co-sponsors of the bill. And in the Senate, not one of the Iowa senators is on board. So I just saw Chuck Grassley here before talking about nuclear power. What does nuclear power have to do with oil? I don't know. We don't produce electricity from oil. We haven't done it for 30 years already. Why are you not on the bill? If you see Senator Grassley or Senator Harkin, that's the question you need to ask him. Why are you not a co-sponsor of the Open Fuel Standard Act? And one of the problems that happens, and I spend more time than I want to and care to on Capitol Hill, I think they all have their own bills. I have my bill. My bill is better than someone else's bill. And the result, we have lots of bills that never make it to the president's desk. And they all want to say that my bill is the one that... But the point is, the Open Fuel Standard Act is a two-page bill. It's a very short bill, very simple bill, a bill that doesn't cost taxpayers a dollar, okay? That's the beauty of it. It doesn't cost taxpayers anything. It doesn't ask for grants. It doesn't ask for subsidies. It doesn't ask for... All it asks is for free market to begin to correct itself. We have, for many years, whether intentionally or unintentionally, we're not going to go into the history of this. My next book is going to deal a little bit of how we got to where we are, but we are where we are, and we have to begin to correct it. Now, when I see the vice chairman of GM standing and publicly admitting that it cost them only $70 to make a car flexible fuel. And Congress doesn't say, okay, if that's what it cost you, then let's make it into a law and now you make it a standard feature in every automobile that you sell, just like you have a seatbelt or an airbag or a rearview mirror, why not make it a standard feature? If it only costs $70, and they say, oh, we don't like mandates. That's their... Now, well, they just accepted a 54 miles per gallon mandate on fuel efficiency. They just accepted a year before a mandate to put rear-end cameras in every car that they sell. So how can you say that you are not willing to accept a mandate that requires a $70 adjustment to the cost of a car? At best, by the way. I think it doesn't even cost that much because my friend Robert Zubrin has been tinkering with those cars and he realized that essentially all you need is some rings that cost 50 cents each and some adjustment to the algorithm, things that really don't cost that much. So you want to ask why they're opposed to it. Well, I really think that the reason that they're opposed to it, the automaker, is because today they have a situation in which they get fuel efficiency credits for putting flex fuel cars on the road. And what happens is that They make, if you look at the flex fuel vehicles that they're selling today, you see they're all 5-liter engine, 6-liter engine, big cars, because that's how they crop the efficiency credits. So they think, okay, if it becomes a standard across all of the models, across all of the vehicles, this loophole is going to be taken away from us, and then we're going to have to invest more money in very expensive technologies like hybrid, like, you know, things that cost a lot of money to meet the efficiency standards. So I think that if my theory is true, I think we can reach some accommodation. I think we need to begin to negotiate with them, and I think we need to pass this Open Fuel Standard Act, mobilizing all of our friends in Congress and all of the people that have been traditional supporters of the biofuels industry, and get it done. Because quite frankly, when I talk to politicians, they, you know, not supporting the Open Fuel Standard Act, not supporting, is the biggest gift you can give to OPEC. You essentially hand a gift to the oil cartel by enabling, aiding and abetting their monopoly so they can coast into their future and keep on extracting our money to feed and spoil all their unproductive people. Now, in the same breath, I want to tell you this. Some of you know me, and you know that I've been a very, very committed friend of this industry. And in this spirit, I want to speak candidly here and take it in this spirit. Look, the industry has suffered major PR setbacks in recent years. One thing that I discovered, that every time the price of oil goes up and there is more demand for alternative fuels, it's the exact time that the industry faces the most fierce and vicious attacks, and the lies and accusations and myths that are being spread and proliferated. So there's a clear correlation. Every time we have high oil prices, we have more bad-mouthing against the only thing that can displace oil. I mean, you'd think that when the house is on fire, the fire brigade gets all the compliments. No, when we are the only people that can really sort of put some cold blanket on the price of gasoline, at that time we see all the most vicious campaigns against ethanol, about ethanol starving the poor, ethanol this, ethanol that, ethanol was behind the assassination of Kennedy, ethanol is behind climate change, ethanol is responsible for all the evils of the world, right? I just had dinner in Florida the other day with an investment banker, and I said something about ethanol. He said, "I hate ethanol." I said, "Why you hate ethanol? What did ethanol do to you?" "I hate it." And then you have the discussion, why and all. And you see, he doesn't really know anything about ethanol. He doesn't really have strong views about the fuel and its properties. But ethanol represents to him something that he hates about Washington. That's a psychological analysis of behind a lot of this. So I think that very soon we're going to have high oil prices again. Whether it's going to be because trouble in the Gulf, a collapse of the euro, I don't know what. There's half a dozen scenarios that I can run here that could push the price of oil to $150, $200, $250, who knows. We want to make sure that next time around we are prepared with all ammunition, and we're not in a position that we sort of sit there and take the blows and say, "Oh, let me check, and I'll come back to you 2 weeks from now with some data." We want to be offensive, not play defense all the time. You know, let me give you an example. This whole food versus fuel fiasco, okay? I hear things like, you know, it's immoral to take food and make fuel and burn it in cars. It's immoral. Well, who determines what moral and immoral is? You know, who owns morality? Why is it that it is more moral to take a can of soda that is, we call it soft drink, but it, in reality it's corn drink. I mean, because corn is the main ingredient after water if you, in a can of soda. Why is it more moral to give your kid a soda drink and make him diabetic and obese than take the same kid to school or to the university? Who decides? But it tells you that when you lose control over the battlefield of ideas, when the other side defines you, you are being defined now. And now you have to explain why you're not what you've been accused to be. And it is extremely important that the next time around, and there will be a next time around, we are far better prepared. I'll give you an example. People talk about ethanol is no good because it takes more energy to produce ethanol than you know, this energy balance story. What is the energy balance of gasoline? What do you think that when you pump oil out of the ground in Saudi Arabia and then move it to a processing facility and then put it on a tanker and the tanker has to sail across two oceans and then it goes to a refinery, that doesn't require energy? Nobody talks about the energy balance of gasoline. Nobody talks about the greenhouse gases cycle and all that stuff. And I'm asking myself, who's behind the scenes? What's happening here? Well, what's happening here that we have an oil lobby that, of course, has its own interests, but we also have a junk food lobby. And the junk food lobby doesn't want competition. It's very simple. And we have a sugar lobby, and the sugar lobby makes sure that the price of sugar in this country is kept twice as high as the world sugar price because the folks in Florida want to maintain those sugar quotas because Florida is a battleground state. And as a result, the Nestles and the Kraft Foods and the Coca-Colas of the world use corn to sweeten our food. And next time you're overseas, take a look at the bottle of ketchup and the candy bar and the soda drink, and you see that they don't use corn syrup, they use sugar. Okay? So every time the price of oil goes up and we use more ethanol, those folks are not happy. They hire the best communication firms in Washington to talk to journalists and explain to them that we starve the poor kids of the world. So we have to redefine this issue. We have to redefine ourselves. We have to change the mindset and go on an offensive and explain the realities of the oil cartel, explain the realities of the need for competition, talk more about the monopoly, talk more, if you want to call it the mandate, the gasoline mandate, this is fine too. We have to redefine the issue, recapture the playing field, go on an offensive, explain that it's always going to be better to put, even if you're opposed to subsidies, it's always better to subsidize hard-working Americans that happen to pay taxes than America hating people out there in different countries of the world that the money goes and never comes back. It never is being plowed back into the economy just like it is here. We have to make the case. And gradually we can get a much more favorable hearing. And at that point, I think people will come to the right conclusions. But it's not going to happen without each and one of you becoming involved. It's not going to happen on itself. We are all troops in a very large army that has no luxury of losing this battle. I cannot emphasize what is at stake here. What is at stake is no less than the question, who is going to control the world economy in the 21st century? Is it going to be free-loving people or is it going to be the enemies of freedom? This is what is at stake here. And if we don't turn oil into salt, if we don't do to oil what humanity did to salt, they will win and we will lose. And we don't want this to happen. Thank you.
Questions?
Sure. The first time, I don't know if you're...